Hi, I'm Brennan Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Dr. Daryl Glover, co-founder of DeFocus Media.
Congrats on being a new dad, by the way.
Oh, thanks so much.
Are you getting enough sleep?
Well, luckily I have an amazing wife that's actually taking care of the young one whenever it comes to me to go to work and make the money. So between my wife and my mother and mother-in-law, someone's always at the house to help out with baby duties. So I'm best on that end.
Speaking of being small, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the tribal area, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. You know, I'm definitely a big UNC fan, although I graduated from NC State. So I always yell out, go Wolfpack, but go Tar Heels at the same time. But I grew up in the tribal area. I spent a little bit of time in Orlando as well, in a high school down there. And came back to North Carolina for college, and for optometry school I went to the Pennsylvania College of Optometry in Philadelphia. So pretty much ran up and down the East Coast for the most part.
The citizen of I-95.
You got it, man. My old Cadillac the Bill, the 2000 model. I took this thing up and down 95 and countless miles. I mean, it was definitely a cougar.
So what did your parents do?
So my father was a project manager for a construction company, and my mother, she's into leasing luxury apartments in the Triangle area.
You became an OD in 2011. Do millennials see optometry different from their older colleagues?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, number one, you can see the profession changing appearance-wise. You're seeing definitely more women in the profession, as well as more minorities as well. Also, just the technology in general. I mean, when a lot of my older colleagues graduated, there really was no social media. So that presence of social media has completely changed the game. So, yeah, it's truly a night and day difference from social media to the technology of contact lenses to even eyewear design. I mean, you're seeing a little bit of everything change and evolve in a better direction.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Oh, man. Let's see. That's a difficult one because pretty much myself in front of everyone, I don't sugarcoat anything or, you know, have some type of fake appearance. So let's see, something they don't know.
All right, so a lot of folks do not know that my mother is from Liberia, and that I'm actually part Liberian and American as well. So that's a fun fact that a lot of people are unaware of. And another quick fact or fun fact is that I'm actually, I was born in Detroit, Michigan. Don't know anything about it, but I'm raised in the Triangle area in North Carolina, so I'm a truly a Southern guy.
Why luxury eyewear sunglasses, and why rely solely on social media to sell them?
I'm a man of luxury. I like nice things. You know, that's why I work so hard. And I love quality. So I started blogging about eyewear years ago, and it kind of evolved from what was in my office into some independent eyewear designers that we didn't sell at the practice that I was at. After forming a relationship with some of those eyewear designers, talking about their products and doing giveaways and stuff of that nature, I found out that was my path that I wanted to take. So that's how I took into the world of luxury eyewear. And, you know, a lot of folks get confused when they're talking about luxury eyewear. A lot of folks think, oh, let's talk about Gucci, Fendi, Prada. I'm not talking about that type of luxury eyewear. I'm talking about your independent eyewear designers, such as RVS Eyewear, Jeremy Perry, and Oliver Goldsmith. I mean, I'm talking about eyewear that people actually hand-make, that use the best products in the world, where there's limited edition, that not everyone really has access to it. So when I'm talking about luxury eyewear, I'm talking about the true luxury independent eyewear as well. Not knocking any of those other brands, but this is something that is very unique in regards to their design and limited as well.
So why rely on social media to sell it?
Social media is a new way. I mean, earlier you asked me, have I seen the profession change? Absolutely, and I'm seeing it change through social media, disruptive technology. A lot of millennials spend a lot of time on social media, so the best way to contact them or have dialogue with them is via social media. So I use that heavily to get a lot of my customers, patients, and it also helps to serve as a great grounds for experimenting. You know, I'll post a picture of some type of product that I potentially want to have on my store, and if folks like the picture and say they like it, and I get direct messaging
saying, hey, I want to buy this product from, you know, X amount of folks, then I know it's something that I need to actually have in my online store as well.
Why do private practice ODs who are into social media, at least start off in social media, why do private practice ODs fall off social media marketing, and how can they stay engaged?
They fall off because they don't have confidence in it. You know, a lot of folks think that you can get a Facebook page, an Instagram page, a Twitter page, and everyone's going to come. And the problem is a few things. Number one, they do not have great content. A lot of times they just repost something that they'll see on some website or some other social media platform. When it comes to social media, you need to customize your content. The content needs to reflect the office as well as the doctors within that office. And a lot of doctors do not do that. They just use the cookie-cutter approach to just copy and paste everything and feel like it's going to be the best solution to actually getting more followers and converting those followers into paying patients as well. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is they don't talk about it in the office. You know, if no one in regards to your patients know about social media, how are you going to have some type of interaction online? So Dr. Lyerly, Dr. Jennifer and I, with our company, Defocus Media, that's something that we actually do for eye care professionals. We actually create customized content for the eye care professional. We bring in their background, their love, their interests, their niche of optometry, as well as some of the local things going on in their community to present their social media platforms. We also educate the eye care professionals that they must teach or educate their patients about their social media platforms. So, you know, having that conversation after you make a recommendation of, hey, you have a quarter change in your prescription, you definitely need to update your glasses with some type of lens technology. Once you get your glasses, we'd love to see a picture of you, you know, styling them in your social media, on your social media platform. So just tag us in that picture. So, you know, that's a good way to lead into educating your patients that they have social media. Also, having it actually on your receipts or having your staff becoming involved makes a world of difference as well. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, folks are not discussing it in their exam rooms, and they're also not staying committed. They have to realize that social media doesn't happen overnight. It's a long process. I mean, it could take months to years to build up that fan base. As long as you're actively engaged into your social media, you can build it quicker.
You have to keep at it if you're going to make it work.
You got to keep at it, man. That becomes easy. You know, like, you know, look at social media kind of like a cold start. You know, you don't get all the patients right away. It takes time to build up, and that's the same way social media is. You know, it's a cold start. You have no fans, no followers, nothing. So it's going to take time to build up until you get that million-dollar practice, just like you get those X amount of followers that actually convert into paying patients or clients as well.
You're licensed to practice in Nigeria, I saw. Why is global optometry important?
It's huge. You know, just optometry in general. You know, when I took that oath in school, my whole thing was to not just help in the States, but all across the world. I feel like in optometry, I feel like in Nigeria, optometry is huge simply because it's one optometrist for like every 40 to 45,000 patients. So there's definitely a need here. So basically, I learned the game being in the States, from selling eyewear to being a technician to being a manager to online access to stores and stuff like that. And I'm just bringing it to Nigeria to put my little spin on it, but also help to propel the profession in several ways, from resources to education to legislation. So, I mean, we pretty much have it mastered in the States, so it's only right to share it with the rest of the world.
Okay, how are you doing that in Nigeria then, currently?
I'm definitely providing resources with one of my companies known as ESE Development, where I do a lot of distribution of various eyewear designs, from independent eyewear designers to some of the big box names that are out there. I have exclusive rights to a few of those companies, and I'm working with some lens companies in this area in regards to distributing lenses. In regards to education, I'm pretty active in the society out here as far as doing vision screenings and going out to the public and talking to them about the importance of eye care, and in the process of now setting up various screenings throughout Nigeria to help those who do not have eyewear or have eye issues that need to be resolved, to get them in the right place, to make sure that they have the vision to improve their quality of life as well. The last thing, the legislation, you know, that's one of those things that's huge. I mean, optometrists in the States are always fighting for their rights, but in Nigeria, it's kind of like maybe, I don't know how long ago optometrists and ophthalmologists were, you know, butting heads with each other, but they're experiencing that here. And being that I've seen how optometrists and ophthalmologists can work and collaborate together, especially being in North Carolina, because we have a great relationship with ophthalmologists there, I'm just bringing those bringing that relationship that I formed and that I've experienced and seen with other eye care professionals to Nigeria and just helping to build the profession here quite a bit.
You're staring down the barrel of parenthood now. What did you used to do for downtime? And are you anticipating any career changes?
You know, downtime for me and for my wife is basically traveling. We love to travel. And we're going to keep that up. I mean, we already have a trip set up for Cancun in October where I've already spoken to my mother and my mother-in-law to watch the baby. So that's not going to stop. So vacation, and we love to eat out. I love to eat out. So a big foodie. As long as they continue to make wonderful restaurants, I will continue to give them money and eat. And those are the two main things, traveling and eating, and, of course, spending time with family. I'm a big family man. So I love spending time with my niece, my mothers, my fathers, even my friends that are close to me, my family. So between family, eating, traveling, you know, I feel like I can still continue doing that stuff regardless of having a young one, because at some point in time, you'll be involved in the food family and the catering as well.
Well, speaking of food, what's your guilty pleasure food?
Oh, man. You know, I like everything. If I had to pick one thing, man, this is kind of a summary. I like my wife cooking. I mean, she's got my heart about you, you know. I love salmon that she makes, grilled chicken, macaroni and cheese. That's my guilty pleasure. And I love something that's fufu and soup.
Fufu
that's
fufu
something that all my
soup?
Africans out there know greatly. Fufu and soup, yes, sir. It's a lot of different ingredients in this soup. It comes with everything, chicken to fish, chicken feet to pig feet. I mean, you name it. Anything you're probably afraid of eating is probably in that soup. But it's amazing. And my mother makes the best batch as well.
Do you have any regrets?
No, not at all. I don't regret anything. You know, I love life. I live every day to the fullest, and I'm going to continue to live that way.
Do you see any changes in ethnic diversity within eye care?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can definitely see it at the school I graduated from, PCO. I think they have the biggest diverse background of students graduating from optometry school. And I see it every day when I walk into the eye care offices. I mean, you know, diverse background, employees, it's more of a melting pot. And I think it's great because, I mean, the profession before was, you know, mainly Caucasian man. And you're seeing it change by seeing more folks of African descent. But also, again, just with women. I mean, you're seeing women take over this industry, which I have no problem with. I love to be surrounded by women, so that's a beautiful thing. But ethnic-wise, yes, yeah, it's a growing profession. And, of course, I'm seeing it every day being in Africa, because that's all I see.
What's one thing you'd change about optometry as it stands now?
Great question. The one thing that I would change is probably the relationship between traditional optometry and disruptive technology. I think that as optometrists, we need to figure out how we can incorporate this disruptive technology that's out there, because it's not going anywhere, and not all of it is bad. I feel like we need to sit down with some of these companies and figure out how we as a profession can work together and use some of this technology in our practices and just make optometry more accessible to folks all across the world.
Well, give me an example of disruptive technology, because that gets bandied around so much.
You know, your online reactions. For example, iNetra. I like their products. You know, I feel like it's something that can be used in an optometric office. Say you have a patient come in, and before you actually go in to do their refraction, if they have this device in their hand, and they've already pretty much found their prescription by a click of a few buttons, you know, basically you put them behind a phoropter, let them see what they're actually, what they found, and make a few tweaks. It will streamline the examination process a lot quicker and make life a lot easier. So, I mean, that's one way of using it. Another way of using some type of technology like that is sending these handheld machines home with patients. For example, if you have a patient that has diabetic retinopathy, a good way to see if that hypoptic shift has actually shifted, they've gone back to their normal prescription, they can actually use that machine, and then you'll get a prescription popping up at your office to show that they're safe. That way you don't have to continuously bring them back in all these times, outside of course dilating the patient to make sure there's no edema that's still taking place there. But it's just a way to indicate if edema has resolved or not. So there's a lot of ways that we can actually implement disruptive technology in the office. Now, there are some companies out there that I would like to see go away, but, you know, there is a lot of great technology out there, and I feel like if we can work with these companies and figure out the best way to implement them into our practices, it'll be a win-win situation. Recently on our podcast, Dr. Lyerly and I had our vision labs, and those guys are willing to sit down with optometrists and see how they can help us grow our profession as well. So a lot of these guys aren't anti-optometry, trying to shut us down. They're just trying to figure out their lane in regards to our practice. And I feel like if we actually are open to listening to them and giving our valid opinions, then we can find a level playing ground. But I feel like we should be the guys that are actually controlling some of this disruptive technology and not just leaving it in the hands of anyone. And these companies are definitely trying to work with us to make that happen. We've actually interviewed a few of these individuals and that are the CEOs or owners of these companies, and that's basically what they're telling us. They're like, hey, how can we help? How can we work together? What do we need to do to move forward? So I think as optometrists, we just need to be a little bit more open-minded in regards to how we can actually implement this technology rather than spending millions and millions, countless dollars on fighting them to actually come into our profession. Let's work together so that we can control it and we can monitor it and we all win at the end of the day for the patient.
Now for the last question, and we inflict this on everybody, what's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Is this at work or outside of work?
I'm leaving that up to you.
Oh, man, the craziest thing I ever done. Wow. See, let's see, something PG-13. Man, the craziest thing that I've done. Great question. The crazy experience, I guess I could say, was when my wife and I and a few of our other friends went ziplining in Jamaica. Now, I know ziplining may be something that everyone's like, hey, I do that all the time on the weekend, but look, I do not like to do anything adventurous. I'm the type of guy, I want to go to the resort, sip my wine, have my nice drinks, enjoy the beach, and also tan. Yes, black folks can tan, so I like to tan as well. But the craziest thing was zip lining. You know, doing the traditional zip lining from, you know, one stage to the next stage. I was scared, but I was cool. But when we got to the end, there was this one part where it was actually a drop, and it was like 100, maybe 100 feet up above. And you literally drop from the top to the bottom. And being that I was scared the entire time, the tour guide, you know, I was basically making his job real difficult. So when it came down to this last thing, I was like, look, dude, I'm not going to actually do this because I'm scared, you know. And he was like, oh, everyone that goes on my tour, they always finish the tour. And, you know, everyone was screaming at me, saying, Daryl, you got to do it. You got to do it. You got to do it. So I ended up doing it. And I was scared, I was just scared. And, I mean, if you could see my face, if you could hear my screams, if you could see how my legs were, I mean, you'd probably pee in your pants because it was that funny. I mean, it was crazy.
But the guy, being that I gave him a difficult time throughout the entire tour, taking time, trying to go through each stage, everyone else he let down real slowly. But when it was my go, maybe the first 5-10 feet, he let me down real slowly, and for the remainder of it, he just let it completely rip. So that's when the screaming, that's when my leg started to dangle, and everything just went crazy. Because he let it go full blast. And to me, that's the craziest thing that I've ever done.
How long was the ride?
So the ride felt like probably like a lifetime when I was going down. But in reality, it was probably like 10 seconds.
It was long as 10 seconds ever.
Oh, man. Like, I even to this day. You know, whenever I hear the word Jamaica, that's the first thing that pops in my mind is that zip line. That's probably why I'm a big fan of vacationing in Jamaica. I told my wife I don't ever want to go back there again. I wasn't impressed. And that probably left a mark on my brain permanently there.
So what was the other one you were going to tell me?
So yeah, when we were in Moorea for our honeymoon, it's right out Tahiti, we had one of the... I don't know what you call it, maybe a water bungalow or something where your place you stay is basically over the water. And the folks come around and they ask you if you want to go swimming with sharks and stingrays and stuff like that. And of course, my scary self said, hell no, I don't want to do that. But my wife, you know, she loves to do all these crazy adventures and stuff like that. She's like, yeah, let's do it. So I swam with sharks and stingrays. And they literally looked at us eye to eye. I mean, it was like the skittiest thing ever in my life. And I was zip lining. And I had to do it because there were kids out there playing that were native to that area. And they were just around fishing, boating, and I did it, you know. That and zip lining are the two things that scared the crap out of me. Craziest things I've done, I should say.
Well, Daryl, it's been just great talking with you today. It's all the questions I have for you.
All right, cool, man. I greatly appreciate it.
So where are you in Nigeria right now?
You in Lagos? I'm in Lagos, Nigeria.
Oh, okay.
That's correct.
All right. All right, thanks a lot.